Kevin is gone this morning. He is getting to go to church with his family down in Racine and getting to see his grandson get baptized. So we are really grateful for him and that opportunity. And so this morning, I get to start off a new sermon series on the book of James. Over the next few months, we're just going to walk verse by verse through the book of James and see what it says to us. And I love this type of preaching. This is my favorite, just to kind of walk through a book like this and see what it says. And this morning, since this is an introduction, we are going to just kind of give a bird's eye view of the book. We're not going to go really deep into one specific text or anything. We're just going to look at it from high up, down, and we're going to answer some questions. Every time you study a book, whether it's just on your own or in a sermon series like this, we have to keep it in context. We have to ask ourselves these questions: who wrote the book? Who was it written to? Why was it written? When was it written? Because the Bible is relevant and it speaks to us today, but it was written to a specific group of people who were facing real issues, and it was written at a time that was much different than ours. And so if we don't remember those things, if we don't keep those things in mind, then we can pull a text out and we could make the Bible say anything we wanted to if we don't keep it in context. And so that's part of my goal. I want to answer some of those questions this morning. And then I want to look at just the key verse. If you were to boil this whole book down to one verse, what would it be? And then I want to look at some of the results of what that verse is saying. So that's the plan for this morning, and this would be a great message to take some notes, because you can refer back over the next few months as we go through this. We'll be referencing a lot of this stuff again, and so that's the plan for this morning. Sound good? Awesome. All right, so here we go. James is written at a time, it's probably the first New Testament book that was actually written. It was very early on in the period. And so because of that, it's written to believers who are new to the faith. This is just maybe 10 or 15 years after Jesus has gone back to heaven. And so all of this is relatively new to people. And James writes with that in mind to this group of people, trying to instruct them, and this is how you are to live as a Christian. So this is how he starts in verse 1. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes dispersed abroad. So, James, he gives us his name, and we know that this is the brother of Jesus, actually. Jesus had siblings, and two of them write books of the New Testament. James is one, and Jude is the other. And the thing about James, just like the rest of his family, he was not a believer in Jesus until after the resurrection. Jesus did his ministry, he preached, he did miracles, and his family oftentimes thought he was crazy. There were times we have recorded in the New Testament where they showed up and they're trying to pull him away because they don't understand what he's trying to do. One of those is in John chapter 7. In verse 1 it says this: after this Jesus traveled in Galilee, since he did not want to travel in Judea, because the Jews were trying to kill him. The Jewish festival of shelters was near, so his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea so your disciples can see your works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he's seeking public recognition. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. See, really what's happening, they're kind of mocking what Jesus is doing. They're trying to get him to leave and go somewhere else, and they're kind of making fun of what he's doing at the moment, trying to get him to leave the area. But just like so many other people, those who started in a state of unbelief, after the resurrection, his belief was completely changed. In 1 Corinthians 15, starting in verse 5, it says this: "And that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to over 500 brothers and sisters at one time. Most of them are still alive, but some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, than to all the apostles. So until Jesus' death and resurrection, James has no belief that Jesus claimed who he was. And let's be honest, that would be a hard thing to handle, right? If you grow up and your brother is claiming that he's God, it's kind of a hard thing to accept, right? He's probably annoyed. Jesus was, I mean, he was a perfect child, right? He never got in trouble. He never did anything. James was never able to say, whenever mom and dad said, hey, who broke this thing in the house? James wasn't able to blame it on Jesus because it was never Jesus, right? So it would be hard to have this acceptance of this guy that I grew up with, this kid that I've lived with and known my entire life. He claims he's God. And so I guess maybe in some ways it's understandable to see James's unbelief, right? But the resurrection changes everything. The foundation of our faith that Jesus came to earth claiming to be God, said that he would die and raise 3 days later, and then fulfilled that promise, that's what we base all of our belief on as well. And so when James sees Jesus resurrected, it changes his entire perspective. He doesn't just go from a skeptic to someone who says, okay, now I believe. Listen to the radical change that happens with him. This is in Galatians chapter 2. Paul is writing, and he says this: when James, Cephas, and John, those recognized as pillars, acknowledged the grace that had been given to me, they gave the right hand of fellowship to me and Barnabas, agreeing that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. Paul calls James a pillar. What he's talking about is of the church. Some of your translations may say that. He goes from being someone who doesn't believe who Jesus was to, after the resurrection, being a key member of the early church. In Acts chapter 15, there's a Jerusalem council that gets established to try to figure out some of the issues going on between, hey, how do Gentiles and Jews fit into this new thing called Christianity? And James oversees the Jerusalem council. He is, by all accounts, the main person in the early church in Jerusalem. And that all hinges on him seeing Jesus raised from the dead. So that's who is writing the book, and he's writing to a group that says dispersed abroad. What he's talking about are just churches in the Asia Minor area. And so this is a general epistle. Sometimes we have a letter, like Corinthians is written to a specific church in Corinth, and they're dealing with specific issues, and Paul's addressing those. This is just a basic letter to all believers, and so he covers a wide range of topics, and instead of addressing specific things, he's just basically trying to get to the point. This is what real faith looks like. That's the premise of the book. Real faith versus fake faith. And this is how he puts it in James chapter 2, verse 17. He says, in the same way, faith, if it doesn't have works, is dead by itself. The entire book is based on that verse. Faith without works is dead. And he writes this to these people, trying to get them to see that belief in God is not enough. Belief in Jesus is only the starting point. It has to go beyond that. And this is a book that over the years people have struggled with. Martin Luther was the kind of the father of the Reformation, what our church belongs to. He had a problem with this book because the idea of works is sometimes foreign to what it seems like the rest of the Bible teaches. We are saved by grace through faith, and it is not of our own doing. That's what Ephesians says. And so whenever this book comes along and says, hey, you have to do works as well, in the early church, people kind of got uncomfortable. They're like, no, we aren't saved by what we do. And that's not what James is talking about. He's not saying you have to earn your way to heaven or you have to do all these things in order for God to look on you with favor. But what he is saying is this: you are saved by faith, But once you are saved, that faith has to propel you to do things. It has to propel you to see fruit in your life. Once the tree is planted and grows up, there has to be apples that start coming off of the tree, or else that tree is dead. And the same thing is true with our faith. That it's not enough to believe, it's not enough to say, yeah, Jesus was God, that's okay. You have to live that out with works. Martin Luther eventually came around and he said this about this idea of faith and works. We are saved by faith alone, but the faith that saves is never alone. It would be like this. If I tell Mallory, my wife, that I love her, but I never do anything to show her that, then is there actually love there? I get her coffee in the morning. I try to help out around the house. I do things to help try to show her that I love her, not just say, oh yeah, Mallory's my wife, so I love her. There has to be action associated with our words, or else it's not real, it's not genuine. And the importance of this verse really goes back to something Jesus says in Matthew chapter 7. In verse 21, he says this, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, didn't we prophesy in your name? Drive out demons in your name and do many miracles in your name?' Then I will announce to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you lawbreakers.'" See, that's the crux of this verse. Faith without works is dead. Because what Jesus says is that there will be a lot of people who stand before God one day, who think they are in right standing with him, and Jesus will say, "No, your faith, I never saw the works, and so I don't know you." See, belief is not enough. Right after this verse in James 2, it goes on to say, hey, guess what? You know who else believes in God? The demons. Satan. They believe in God, but they don't have a saving faith in him. Because belief is not enough. We have to go beyond just saying, yes, I think Jesus was God, and put things into action in our lives. And so there's two groups of people that really this kind of targets. The first one is just the hypocrite. There are some people who kind of play the part, that they come to church because they think they're supposed to, or they were raised in church, or it makes someone in their family happy. And they put on a good act, but they don't really try to live that way throughout the week, and they don't care to. It's fine, like, I'll go to church on Sunday, that's okay. But it's really just a part that they're playing. Teddy Roosevelt, whenever he was running for office one day, a delegation came to his door, and he met them at the door, and he started rolling up his sleeves, and he said, hey, come, let's talk down in the barn. And so he walked down to the barn, and he grabbed a pitchfork, and he started to look around. He was like, I'm going to work while I talk to you guys. And he started looking around, and there wasn't any hay that he was going to, you know, start pitching. And so he yelled down, hey, John, where's all the hay at? And he heard back from his worker in the barn. He said, oh, sorry, sir, I haven't moved it back from the last time the Iowa delegation was here, right? Politicians haven't changed much, I guess, in 100 years, right? We all sometimes could play the part. We sometimes can put on a show and try to put on a good face in front of people. But unless there's genuine love, unless there's genuine works behind what we do, then that's all it is playing the part. And that might be a few people here, but really the question that is asked to the other group of people, the more important one, the one that probably applies to more people in today's day and age, is those with a false sense of security. Those who, man, they think that everything between them and God is good. They think because they were baptized as a kid, but that they have not lived for him now that they're still okay because they were baptized 40 years ago. They think because they show up to this building every day on Sundays when it's open that, hey, that's good. That gets me into heaven. They think that just because they were raised in church, that that's enough to make them think that they are saved. And they have this false sense of security, and they are the ones who will stand before Jesus one day, and he will say, I never knew you because your faith is not enough. I never saw the works produced in your life. I never saw you love other people. I never saw you work to get to know me better. I never saw you open your Bible to try to spend time with me. I never saw you do the works that are expected of you when you have faith in me. That's the group that James is addressing and trying to get them to see it has to go beyond faith. And so, what are some of those works that he talks about? There are kind of five key elements that he addresses throughout the book, and he points to and says, this is what your life should look like. If you're going to have these works, this is what he is talking about. And the first one is where he starts off in verse 2, right after his greeting. It says, consider it a great joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you experience various trials, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its full effect so that you may be mature and complete, lacking nothing. Real faith produces endurance. That's the first work that we see in James. Real faith produces endurance. What he's saying is this, that trials are going to come. In your life, there are going to be things that happen because we live in a broken world that has been warped because of sin. And while we are in this world, we are going to face trials. And those trials should help deepen our faith. As we walk through them, it helps us get closer to Jesus. Whenever I was in high school, my church did something called a fifth quarter. So after football games on Friday night, they would have games and food and just stuff for high school students to come after the game and a place to hang out and everything. And so they would do a lot of inflatables and things like that. And in one week, they had it was an inflatable boxing ring. But the gloves were not your typical boxing gloves. They were, I don't even know, maybe 10 pounds. They were like the size of my torso, okay? And so you had to reach in and like grab a bar. And so you couldn't really swing them all that hard. But it was still fun to get in there and stuff like that, you know. Well, I decided to get in the ring with one of my buddies. His name was Clint. And Clint was a linebacker for our football team. And he was not just a linebacker. He was a very, very good linebacker. He was the one that was always, like, delivering the big hits on a Friday night. And so we get in the ring, and at first we're just messing around, you know, hitting kind of some body shots, stuff like that, and it's a fun time. But then the problem became that, like I said, Clint, he looks like you think a linebacker looks like, and I look like this. And so when Clint was actually done messing around, he popped me in the face so hard. My nose instantly started bleeding. I fell back onto the inflatable. And after the one actual hit I took, I threw in the towel. I was done, right? It's like, all right, that was fun. I'll give someone else a turn. It's okay now, right? Life is going to hit you in the face. That's what James says. When you face trials, it's going to happen. And when it happens, you can't throw in the towel. You don't get to say, I'm done, if you have real faith. You ask the question, God, what do you want me to learn? See, oftentimes we ask the question, why is this happening? God, why would you allow something like this to happen? But that's not the right question. The right question when you're going through the trials is, God, what do you want me to learn? so that I can grow, so that I can get back up, so that I can endure and make it to the end, because that is what real faith looks like. Real faith produces endurance. Real faith also produces action. Skipping down to verse 22 of chapter 1, he says this, "But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Because if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like someone looking at his face in a mirror. For he looks at himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of person he was. But the one who looks intently into the perfect law of freedom and perseveres in it is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer who works. This person will be blessed in what he does." See, there's a difference between hearing someone and listening to someone. And what James is saying here is, like, you can't just hear the word preached. You can't just read through a section of scripture on a Tuesday morning with a cup of coffee and then let that be the end of what you do. We can't just be hearers. We have to be doers. Whenever we hear a message or read a text, we have to ask the question, okay, what do I do now? Now that I've seen what Jesus' word says, then what action do I take? What am I supposed to do in light of what I've been told? There's times where I'm sitting on the couch and Mallory's trying to talk to me and I'm probably looking at my phone or something and I'm hearing what she's saying, right? And I'm doing the, yeah, no, yeah. And then the conversation is done. I'm not hearing anything any longer and I'm like, uh-oh. And I have to admit, hey, I really wasn't listening to you. I was hearing what you said, but I actually don't know what we were talking about, right? And I wonder how many times we are like that with God. We come and we listen to a message or we read a text and we're hearing it, but until we actually apply it to our lives and do what it asks us to do, then we're not really listening. Real faith produces endurance, and real faith produces action, that we do what we're asked to do by God. And it also produces a controlled tongue. And this is one that James hits on that honestly might be the easiest indicator to know, okay, are my words and my actions lining up? This is what he says about controlling your tongue in verse 5 of chapter 3. "So too, though the tongue is a small part of the body, it boasts great things. Consider how a small fire sets ablaze a large forest. And the tongue is a fire. The tongue, a world of unrighteousness, is placed among our members. It stains the whole body, sets the course of life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. Every kind of animal, bird, reptile, and fish is tamed and has been tamed by humankind, but no one can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With the tongue we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in God's likeness. Blessing and cursing come out of the same mouth. My brothers and sisters, these things should not be this way." That one hurts to read every time, right? Here's the thing. James says there is a direct indication of, does real faith in your life help you control your tongue or not? In the previous chapters, in verse 1, he says that if you don't control your tongue, your religion is worthless. And that goes beyond curse words. That is including gossip, that includes sarcasm, that includes passive-aggressive comments that we make to our spouse or to our friends, that includes the things that we put on social media. They didn't have Facebook back then, but James probably would have said controlling your fingers on your phone if they did. All of that is a direct result of what does your faith look like? Is it real or is it fake? The next thing that he mentions is that real faith produces wisdom. Skipping down just a few verses to verse 13. Who among you is wise and understanding? By his good conduct he should show that his works are done in the gentleness that comes from wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't boast and deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there is disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom from above is pure, then peace-loving, gentle, compliant, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without pretense. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who cultivate peace. So here's what he says heavenly wisdom looks like. The fruit that should be evident in our lives, this is what it looks like. To be pure, this means that your thoughts and your motives are righteous. That you are thinking holy thoughts. Peace-loving, that means right relationships between man and man. That you're not writing people off. That as soon as someone does something that offends you or that you don't like, that you're not saying, I'm done with that person. But it seeks to have right relationships with them. Gentle. This is not necessarily the word we would think of when it comes to gentle, but it's knowing when it is right to actually not apply the letter of the law. When it's right to give some grace. So the other day we were eating lunch in town. We were having a picnic because both of our oldest boys are in preschool and their classes are an hour apart. And so instead of driving here and then driving back in and everything, we picked Emmett up from his class and then we went to the park and we just had some sandwiches that we were gonna eat before we took Elisha to his class. And we had this packet of mustard that Elisha had in his hands, and he was messing with it at first, and I told him, I was like, hey buddy, put that down because it's gonna break and you're gonna get mustard all over you. And so about 10 seconds later, I'd walked to get something out of the van and I come back and you probably know what happened. He's covered in mustard, right? And I started to get mad at him because I was like, I just told you to put it down, right? But right away he was like, oh, Emmett wanted mustard. And so I was trying to open it for him so that he could put it on his sandwich. And so by the letter of the law, he did not obey what I told him to do, right? I told him to put down the packet because that was what was going to happen. But by the spirit of the law, he didn't do anything wrong. He wasn't playing with the packet like he was at first. He was trying to help out his brother. And so I couldn't get mad at him because even though he had to go to school smelling like mustard, he was trying to do something nice for his brother. And that's what this word is talking about, gentleness. Knowing when it's appropriate to give grace and not hold people to a standard that's just, hey, this is black and white, right and wrong. That's what this wisdom looks like. Compliant. It doesn't demand its way. It's willing to say, hey, this is what I want, but I'm not gonna dig in my heels and demand that we have to do things this way. It's working with a group and being willing to say, that's not what I want, but it's okay. Not being rigid and being willing to yield. Full of mercy. That just means caring for those in need. For the people that are around us that we see who need our help. In James 1:27, he says, religion that is pure and undefiled is to look after widows and orphans in their distress. In the Bible, widows and orphans basically encompass all those who can't take care of themselves. Today, we would have programs that would be willing to help out those two groups of people. In the time of the Bible, that was not the case. There were not jobs for those kinds of people. There were not programs that would help. And so a widow or an orphan were completely on their own. Their family would be the only ones who may be willing to take care of them. And so that group represents those who are in need. And James says that's what heavenly wisdom looks like, to care for those who are in need. Unwavering. We talked earlier about being compliant in the right situations, but there's also a time to hold to biblical convictions and to stand on the truth, and that's what this is talking about. To be willing to say, no, this is right, there is no gray matter here, and I will stand on that no matter what. And the last one is without pretense. It's honest. It doesn't pretend to be what it's not. Back to that idea of hypocrisy. And the final thing that James hits on, what real faith looks like, it produces endurance, it produces action, it produces a controlled tongue, it produces wisdom, and finally, it produces humility. What I love about the intro to James, it's such a simple thing, but I mentioned two of Jesus' brothers actually have books in the New Testament that they wrote, and both of them give the simplest greeting that we have. Paul, sometimes he'll start a letter and he'll say, Paul, and a servant of Jesus Christ and an apostle. James, man, if it was me, I'd be throwing in brother of Jesus, right? Like, James, servant and brother, by the way, of Jesus. But he doesn't care about that. And Jude does the same thing. Their introduction is just Jude, servant of Jesus. And so we see James's humility just right at the beginning of the letter. But he also talks about this when it comes to humility in chapter 4. Starting in verse 13, he says this, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will travel to such and such a city and spend a year there, and do business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring, what your life will be. For you are like vapor that appears for a little while, then vanishes. Instead, you should say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." So this was what he says in terms of humility. We are not even promised tomorrow. How can we be proud or arrogant about things when the only reason that you or I woke up this morning and were able to swing our feet out of bed was because God allowed us to? Life is like a vapor that is here one moment and gone the next. And when we keep that in mind, it keeps us humble. I was thinking about, it was a year ago this weekend that we were celebrating the 150th anniversary. If you were around for that, you probably remember all the things that happened. And Donna Birchall had put together a history in a book of our church. She was able to find a lot of records and things like that. And one of the things she found was a list of all the people that had served in ministry here, going all the way back. There's this huge list, whether it was senior minister or someone who filled in for a time or youth minister. And looking over that list, it was incredible. There's a ton of people. And as I looked at it, there were a couple names I recognized, right? A few people that I've worked with, a few people that I just had heard of. People mentioned their names, like, yeah, this guy was here about 20 years ago, and things like that. But after about five or six names up, like, I don't know who that person is. And that's true for pretty much everyone except for maybe two or three of you here. You don't have to go very far back, and you're just a name on a page. And I'm trying to depress you, but what I'm trying to tell you is that your life is a vapor. What we do matters, and we should pour our life out for the kingdom. But we have to be humble, because in 50 years and in 60 years, no one's going to remember who we are. People here aren't going to know who I was in this pulpit. People aren't going to remember those types of things. And that keeps us humble, because God gives us this time, says, pour your life out for me, work for the kingdom, do everything you can to make my name known, to bring lost souls to me. And then when your time is done, it's someone else's job. Real faith keeps us humble and in our place, knowing that truth. just in the last few weeks. I grew up in Illinois, and so my mom and dad will send me messages and stuff about things that are going on back home occasionally. And just in the last few weeks, there have been two people. One was in my brother's class, who's just a few years older than me. And the other was one that was just a year. A year older than me, that I grew up going to church with, who have passed away. Both of them 40 years old and younger. We are not promised tomorrow. We don't know. We could leave this building and get hit by a semi on the highway. Like I said, I'm not trying to depress you, but I know I am, but that's what James says. Real faith understands we are just given a short period of time in order to keep us humble and to keep us in our place and understand, hey, God is the real star. Everything we do, we point glory back to Him. He is the one that matters. Giving Him praise and honor and glory is the only thing that we do with our life that really makes a difference. That's what real faith looks like. So over the next 3 or 4 months, we're going to be in this book, going verse by verse and breaking it down. And one of the things that you will hear if you look up a commentary or if you listen to a message on this book, the word that preachers love to use when it comes to James is that it's practical. It's kind of like the Proverbs of the New Testament, that it's full of these sayings and things that just give us like wisdom for the day. But practical really just means code for this book kind of gets in your face. It's going to step on your toes. Because theology is one thing. When we talk about like how is God three in one, and that's a concept that's way above us and it's fun to think about and hear sermons on and things like that. But practical texts, when it's like, hey, this is how you live, and if you don't, you're not really doing what you're supposed to do. That steps on your toes a little bit. And so, be ready for that. Be open to that. Just know that it's going to challenge you. But it's also going to help you answer the question, is my faith real? Is it genuine? Am I walking the walk or am I just talking the talk? And it will help us see, do I have works along with my faith or is my faith dead?